Hi, my name is Chris Jan, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Jan.
Really great to be here. And I just want to start by saying something that I heard someone say in her share once when I was a newcomer, which is that if you're here tonight as a newcomer and you're not sure whether whether it is for you or whether you're an addict or whether you should be here, then excuse me, do yourself a favor and just stay and sit back and listen. I loved listening to you, Mark. Thank you. And I wrote down something here. You said, if I do what's on offer, life is good, and I'm the one who makes it hard. And I so identify with that, with both parts of that. And what is on offer here is, in my experience, a series of suggestions that are just incredibly simple and straightforward. And when I do them, I get recovery. So my sponsor said, open the book and read the very first blurb on the cover of the book. That's two sentences. Pick up a pencil and write one of the questions in my step work. Pick up the phone. Say yes when someone puts me forward to be the tea person at a meeting. Come to a meeting. You know, it's all, this SIP program is practical, and I love what it says, that if a solution is not practical, it's not spiritual. And that for me is very counterintuitive, that how can I do these, you know, how is doing these practical things spiritual? And maybe it's not in themselves, you know, like opening the book and reading isn't maybe a spiritual act, but what I get from that enhances my spiritual life, because all of those suggestions are about learning to practice self-love, and that is the antidote to the practice of self-destruction, which is what my addiction was. At the end, you know, my using was like everybody's here. At the end of my, you know, not at the end actually, just I suppose in the middle when it was quite bad, I was homeless and pregnant twice. Both times I was pregnant, I happened to find myself homeless. Living in a bed and breakfast, temporary accommodation in Russell Square with my partner. You know, woke up one night in this bed that, you know, I don't know, many, many people had slept in and pissed in and puked in and fucked in. And I got up and looked at myself in the mirror and thought, I just, you know, the moon was shining. It was just one of those moments, you know, I couldn't sleep, tossing and turning, 7 months pregnant. And I looked at myself in the mirror and just thought, how did this happen? This was so far away from the kind of future that I foresaw for myself as a child, you know, the sort of fairy tale of being pregnant and having babies and having a family. And the reality of it for me was so radically different from what I, you know, even my very modest aspirations in that regard. And, you know, I said when I got when I get pregnant, I'll stop using. And I used every day through the first pregnancy. When I have the baby, I'll stop using. 45 minutes later, I was using. Oh, when I get pregnant again, I'll stop. You know, so it goes, attempts to control. And I couldn't stop until my children were 4 and 5. And I found that the destruction of my life, you know, I kind of thought when I hit my rock bottom, okay, that's it. But the momentum of the destruction carried on into my, you know, the consequences of my using. And I was 45 days clean and found that my children had been rather seriously treated. Sorry, should I just... I found that my children had been very seriously mistreated by someone who I had left them with while I was using, and I had to deal with the consequences of that, which was, you know, involved in social services and, you know, just dealing with a lot of professionals that at 45 days clean I didn't feel equipped to deal with. And I got so much support from the fellowship that I realized I needed to stay here in NA to changed my life. I don't, you know, I didn't, you know, as Mark was saying, I didn't stop the first time I felt that my using was bad. My using had to get incredibly bad for me to ask for help, because asking for help became an impossible thing to do. And I called the helpline in a state of despair and went to a meeting the next day. You know, the end of my using was couldn't sleep, use, puke, have a glass of water, use again, try to sleep fitfully, wandering up Kilburn High Road at 3, 4 in the morning, trying to get tobacco, seriously underweight, a lot of health problems, financial problems, relationship, every kind of problem. So I was really at a state, and found in the meetings what was so attractive. Some part, some little spark in me was still attracted to the acceptance that I felt in the meeting. And I was thinking about that today, just about acceptance being a spiritual gift of recovery that I can apply to myself and to other people, that I can accept only because I was accepted for who I was when I came to meetings am I able to accept other people. I've learned it's a reciprocal thing. And I was thinking about tradition one, and it says in the reading that we are accepted and loved for who we are, not in spite of who we are. No one can revoke our membership or make us do anything that we do not choose to do. And it took me a while to feel that I belonged here, because I felt so different from, you know, at the meetings that I went to, I was definitely, you know, the obvious kind of newcomer, really in a bad way with a lot of problems. And I looked around and everybody seemed so cool and relaxed and, you know, content with their lives. But as, you know, Mark was saying, I heard them sharing and I thought, God, I would share that if I was really honest about how I felt. That's what I would share. But it kept everything so close to my heart that I wasn't able to let myself be known. Still, I was accepted and received with a hug, even though I smelt and I, you know, was not well, and people drove me home and picked me up and took me to meetings. And it just, bit by bit, it got to me, and I started following the suggestions, and I found that it's so incredibly gradual. It's only when I look back, and I met someone recently I hadn't seen for a long time, and I love that when people reflect back, you know, the progress. You know, someone says, I remember you from your very early days, and my God, you've changed so much. And, you know, and I have changed so much. I came into the fellowship 8-some-odd years ago with a head full of dreadlocks. I was very, very thin. I was so, kept my head down. I used to know people from the meetings by the shoes they wore, because I only ever looked down. And usually being resentful, like thinking they must be doing well, they can own shoes like that. You know, the thing about my hair was interesting, because I cut my locks off when I was a year clean. And when I combed the hair through for the first time in I don't know how many years, my head was full of lice. And I lived like that, you know. My head was itchy. I just thought my head was itchy, you know. And I thought, I de-liced my kid's hair. I had so much lice in my hair. And I thought, my God, I was living with that. That was like my common denominator. That was, and that is, you know, I still see that in my life. Like I was thinking on the way here, I used to, are you watching the time? Because I didn't, okay, great. I used to go do my grocery shopping once a week, shop for me and my two children, and carry a week's worth of groceries home on the handlebars of my bike and push it, you know, 45 minutes home, because I am not going to pay for a taxi like that, with gritted teeth and white knuckles and backache. You know, this was not a good way to be doing things. I wasn't going to spend like £7 on a taxi. So, you know, the kind of poverty thinking in every way, I don't deserve that, and that's for other people. And I started a year ago, actually I'd been to the osteopath, and I thought, this is ridiculous, costing me £40 to see the osteopath, probably because I'm pushing my groceries home. So it was a false economy, and now I go do my grocery shopping, and three times a month, I take my groceries home in a taxi, and the taxi driver usually helps me to the door, and my kids come down and help me carry it up. And I can't do all of this on my own. And when I get most like agitated and frustrated, I hear myself saying to my kids, just that, I can't do this on my own. You know, you're on the computer and you're watching TV and I'm doing the dishes and I'm cooking the food. And instead of just saying, look, can I have some help? Like, they are willing to help. Could you help me do the dishes? And we always have a laugh when we do it together. But I find it so difficult to ask for help, and I find it so difficult to bust myself in those situations where, like, this is not good for me, you know. What can I do to change this? It's the acceptance thing. I have to accept that I don't drive, but I have to get the food home some way. So maybe spending £7 a week or whatever is money well spent. So I can look at that in other areas of my life. What else is causing me pain and discomfort? You know, I don't feel well when I don't do exercise. I am someone who, I get depressed. I can easily just spend the whole weekend under the duvet in front of the TV thinking that that's what I need, and then I feel really depressed. I need to get up and move around so I can say to myself, I need to spend a bit of money doing a yoga class or take a bit of time out to meditate and reflect. You know, it just does not come naturally for me to do the loving thing for myself. And that's why doing what's on offer. When I do the suggestions, I feel really good about myself. And it's just using all those examples to illustrate that it's ongoing, that I'm still living with a level of discomfort in my life that I'm not maybe aware of. I mean, I know, for example, I'm not earning my living from my creative work, and I would like that to happen, but I can take small actions to make that happen. But it usually takes me to feeling real discomfort before I can take the action. I was thinking about one of the spiritual benefits as well from the program for me is the experience of unity, which I grew up in a family with three sisters and my mom, and we all competed fiercely for my father's attention. So I was very competitive. You know, that was kind of my baseline existence as well. I had to compete, you know. I'm not in a real sort of, reasonable way, like competing to be the fastest runner or to be, you know, things that were measurable. It was more this kind of manipulative thing about getting attention. And I felt that when I came into the rooms, I was aware, you know, someone said to me, we come into the rooms and we act out the dynamic of our families in the rooms, and then kind of through working the steps, untangle them and they become clear and we can move on from that. And that's been my experience, for example, going to the women's meeting and thinking, oh, I really only feel safe with women, I'm going to stick with the women's meeting. And you know, and then, like, oh my God, did I ever realize I had a lot of problems with women, and I resented them all. And so, I thought, well, God, I got problems with men, and I got problems with women. Well, now where am I going to go? My sponsor said, you have to keep going. You know, you've got a commitment at the meeting. You can't run away. Just keep going, and it'll change. It really has changed. It's only changed because I know myself so much better now. I know that I can say, for example, I remember doing service at Region, and someone asked me a question, and there's like 40 people turning and looking at me, and I thought, I don't know the answer to that question. And I felt myself sit forward on the chair, and I was about to lie and say, you know, make up the answer, because that was my strategy, just bullshit my way and pretend that I knew. And I looked around and thought, well, they're all in recovery, and something, I just sat back and said, I'm really sorry, I don't know the answer, but I'll find out for you before the next meeting. And everyone just said, oh, okay, that's great, and carried on. You know, it wasn't all about me. And if I can find that humility, I mean, I don't think I had ever said, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer. You know, that's part of that competition thing that, you know, in my family. And to be able to say, there are some things that you can do better than I can do. And, you know, doing service and feeling like some people would get praise for the service they'd done, and I would think I'd get envy, that kind of burning envy. I want the praise. I want the approval of that old-timer who's got 25 years clean, who's telling her she's done a great job. And instead of thinking, you know what, she really has done a great job. And saying that, giving that, you know, well done, you can do something that I can't do. And that is what unity is, that this meeting needs someone to set up the chairs, to be the secretary, to be the speaker, to deal with difficult members, to make the tea. We need that. And that It is unity in diversity, and I felt that very strongly this week. I stayed up late with my kids and watched the election, and I really, really wish I had stayed up longer to hear the victory speech. But this is the first, and I'm Canadian, and we've always taken a real interest in American politics, and it's the first time that my entire family has been united in supporting the candidate. And I thought that is so incredible, that my 83-year-old father, who, you know, I wouldn't describe him as a racist, but he has bigoted views. You know, he grew up in a very small town during the Depression in southwestern Ontario, very poor. You know, he's got his stuff, and you know, and we were all united to support the, you know, a person who personifies hope, dignity, humility, you know, all of the qualities that I am attracted to about people in the fellowship, things that I want for myself. And I woke up Wednesday morning, quickly ran to the TV and turned it on and felt so moved and so elated. And I felt like, isn't it amazing? I'm here in this very historic time. I'm witnessing a complete shift. You know, this, we want hope. We want something to believe in that's positive, that's not about greed. And, you know, and we're part of the mill of that, you know, churning that out. We're turning, my life is turned around. Your lives are turned around because we come here and we share our stuff honestly. And it was just so incredible for me to see that reflected back on such a huge and important platform. And then I went to take my dog for a walk, and, you know, it was like walking on air, and I met three people and said, isn't it a great result? You know, they said, yes. And I met these two old Eeyores, I call them, you know, pessimistic. Oh, well, it'll be a short honeymoon period. Oh, well, you're going to be terribly disappointed. And I thought, no. You know, what has happened has already happened. This is a country divided that is united, you know, a country that's been ostracized by the rest of the world that is now being welcomed back in. You know, there is a lot to be hopeful for. When I did my step two, my sponsor said, write down a hope list, everything that you hope. Go crazy, you know, like things that you wouldn't want to share. You know, you might think, I think it's too outrageous to say that, write it all down. Relationships, family, where you want to live. I wrote all this stuff, complete fantasy. You know, I want to live in a flat with a garden. Oh, how am I ever going to get out of that? My council flat. How am I ever going to earn enough money to write it down? I want a flat with a garden. I like to have a little dog. Oh, I've got asthma, kind of allergic to dog. Write it down. I want a dog. I want to have a relationship with my children where I don't shriek and rage and want to control them so much that I'm in agony myself. Wrote that down. You know, I want to have a relationship with someone who's emotionally mature, as I wasn't. I want to be emotionally mature myself. I want to have a job that I earn my money through my creative effort. I haven't got everything on that list. My sponsor, that is not for you to, this is now step three. It's not for you to work out how you are going to get there. You just keep going to your meetings. You keep doing step work. Keep answering the phone call when a newcomer calls. Keep doing a gratitude list. These things are going to come. And this is the miracle of the program. I am in a flat now. I was transferred out of my flat because of the problems that I had when my son's, you know, I was living in a very, very rough estate where, you know, a 15-year-old stabbed and killed another young man. A lot of dealing and using and abuse, and I was applied for a transfer, and I got a transfer to a really amazing flat with a garden. And last year, you know, my kids pestered me for 3 years. I did a degree in recovery. I knew I couldn't get a dog while I was doing a degree. As soon as the degree was over, we started investigating through the rescue, and we gave a home to a little dog that would have been destroyed. And I love that little dog, and she gets me out the door for a walk every morning. And these are simple. I don't fight with my children. Sometimes I do, and I lose it. But we have a really great relationship. We've been playing Monopoly for 6 nights. We've got this whole, I don't like board games, but I like to be with my kids doing something. And, you know, my son comes home, he says, Are we playing Monopoly tonight? I've been looking forward to it all day, and I think, oh God, not Monopoly. But when I get into it, and they take the mick out of me the whole time, you know, oh, you're in jail again. I keep ending up in jail. But I don't like board games, because I played with two of my sisters once at Christmas, and my sisters are older, and they said, I got to get out of jail. No, I was in jail, and my sister got a get out of jail free card. She said, I'll sell it to you for, you know, $1,000. I said, okay. And then they both started laughing. So it's only worth $50. You could have got out of jail in three turns anyway. So tore the card in half, and then my sister cried, and Dad, she ruined my Christmas present. And my father said, go upstairs and get the belt, you know. So I went upstairs, and I thought the leather belt was the usual one. And then I thought, well, actually, what's this pair of trousers with the cotton belt that came with the trousers? I took that off, and I gave him that. And actually, he smiled, which was incredibly unusual. But, you know, but board games, you know, board games are kind of boring. I'm just not into it, but it's been such a delight. You know, that's a joy for me of recovery. And, you know, when I was using, if I had to listen to a middle-aged woman tell me she got pleasure playing Monopoly with her kids, I probably would have left. But I hope I'm not carrying a boring message. For me, is that my life is very extraordinary because it is so ordinary. And the unmanageability of my life when I was using took more energy than I had, and that's why I was depleted. And now I have enough energy that I can give something to my children, to service in the fellowship, to my 85-year-old, actually she's not 85, she told me her age, she's 91 on Sunday, my neighbor who's immobile, and I go over and my kids do her hoovering for her, we do that together. And I feel a part of my community because I do that. I feel a part of this fellowship because I come and I know you and I know you and I, you know, and I've hugged you and I've talked to you on the phone and, you know, I am a part, I belong here. And I wanted to tell you because I don't think I've really talked about the steps. I hope I've given a message of suggestions and things, you know, definitely working the steps. And I want to say about step 11, because I've been in step 11. I've been through all the steps, and I feel like I go through different stages where I think, oh, I'm really in step 10 now at the moment. And right now I feel I'm very much in step 11 and pushing a little bit further to my understanding of my spiritual life and purpose and practice, my spiritual practice. And part of that for me is that I started doing yoga a year ago. Again, because I've done it for a long time. I do have this really chronic, troubling respiratory problem, of which asthma is a part, and they keep giving me these terribly strong drugs, and I don't want to take them anymore, so I started doing yoga, and I've got this amazing teacher who, he said last week, he was talking about this principle called dukkha. You know, you're kind of lying in a posture and thinking, is this right? My hands, my feet, my hips, my neck, you know. And he said, stop fidgeting, you know, dukkha is, he sent me an email about it because I asked him, it's dissatisfaction, it's an inherent characteristic of conditioned existence, and craving perpetuates the experience of it. And I love that because, like, the more I try to fiddle and get it perfect, the less I am experiencing the thing that I'm supposed to experience and getting the benefit from it. And perfectionism and controlling and self-centeredness and envy when I'm in the dog pose and I look through my legs and I think, God, she's got her heels to the ground. How does she do that? I can't do that. And I'm envious. You know, I thought, isn't that weird that this is an ancient Sanskrit word? What I call, like, it was my internal critic, it's my mother's voice saying, you're not doing it properly. And I thought, I felt a real relief that it's not. It's something that for hundreds and hundreds of years people have been talking about this. We all experience, as human beings, an inherent lack of satisfaction about what we're doing. And I just felt this acceptance about that. I thought, if I can accept that, then I can get the benefit of it. As opposed to going into a whole psychoanalytical thing, oh, it's my mother, and my mother was always very critical, and that's where my perfectionism comes. Just saying, I can accept that in everything I do, there's a part of me that doesn't feel satisfied with that. Therefore, I'm satisfied with what I'm doing. It is good enough, you know. I need to just sit down. My step four, you know, just sit down and write it, and it's good enough. As long as I'm thorough and I pray for honesty, it's good enough. And same with my spiritual practice. I don't work. I tried to at the beginning. I've got to meditate. Okay, sit down every day, 10 minutes. My kids would come in and I'd say, shut up, leave me alone, I'm trying to meditate. You know, it was so spiritual. And then I thought, how do you get to the point where you're so blissed out? I mean, I had huge expectations in myself that I would be actually able to sit calmly and be blissed out while my, oh, they're running around. And, you know, I was furious. They were making a mess, you know. I think, you know, I feel like the unity that we have here is, you know, I always say this, it's my favorite part of the book, is the description of the symbol, the four sides, the base of the pyramid, and the broader the base of the pyramid, the greater we are in number, it says, and the more diverse we are in fellowship, in membership, the higher the point of personal freedom. So this is not like as soon as I came in the door, no one else was going to come because I was going to work my way up, you know, which is what happens out there when you go for a job, you know. This is the inverse of that. So that when I walked in, I was the newcomer. I was the most important person at the meeting, and I benefited from that. The more people that come in and the more diverse they are, the greater my personal freedom will be, because everyone who comes in brings something of importance to the fellowship, and they challenge my notions of tolerance and acceptance, and people have different views about things. And if you haven't experienced that and you haven't done service yet in NA, you will find that, you know, if you go to an ASC or doing any kind of service work, you know, sometimes, you know, we muddle our way through things, but this idea of the group conscience, it's not my decision, and I can't manipulate people to think a certain way. We take a vote on it, you know, and the higher power is there, you know, in the group conscience. So I have experienced that, the benefit of that unity, that we're all welcome. How much time is there left? 10 minutes. Okay. Okay, then I'd like to talk about the steps and how I work the steps. I was 90 days clean. My sponsor said, get your 90-day chip, and then we'll start working the steps. And I worked through the Green and Gold book. And I wasn't sure, really. I was one. That's why that woman saying, if you're not sure if you belong here, do yourself a favor and stay. That's why that resonated with me, because I wasn't really sure. I sort of thought my using hadn't been as bad. I'd hear people describing things and think, oh God, I didn't do that. And in my step one, my sponsor stopped me when I was reading it and said, do you still have any doubts that you're an addict? And I said, no. You know, I remember writing about the dangerous situations I put my children in so that I could score, how I neglected myself and my children. My life was definitely unmanageable, but I just thought it was. You know, I thought, you know, I remember coming on, my life got very small. I couldn't take the tube because I was too paranoid. I stopped taking the bus because the sound of when the beep, 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 when the doors open used to drive me crazy. So I just walked. I had a bicycle. Oh, the bike was stolen. I thought, well, that's okay. I think my cycling days are over now. That's been another wonderful thing that's come back to me in recovery. And my world got very small. And one day I did have to take the tube. And I remember seeing the posters for films and thinking, oh, yeah, I used to like going to the movies sometime. Oh, but that's all. You know, I was so prepared to let, oh, well, that's gone now, and that's gone, and, you know, just to throw everything away, things that gave me pleasure. I used to think, oh, well, it's a luxury, you know, to go to the cinema. You know, I don't have that luxury now. So that those are all things, that's self-deprivation and self-abuse and not being able to be an adult and manage my life properly. Step two was hope. I talked about the hope that I wrote down, admitting... So step two was admitting that my thinking was insane, that, you know... So that's why my thinking was so limited, that I didn't believe that I could have a flat with a garden. So that's where the hope list came from. Step three, you know, that I could have... I did believe in God. Grew up in a very... My father was extremely... came from a Baptist tradition, and my cousins would speak in tongues and get possessed, and now, you know, hitting them in the head and falling back, it was all very dramatic, and I never, my father renounced all of that. We used to go to church with my cousins, and the local pastor, my uncle was the pastor, and he'd say, "Now anyone who feels the love of Jesus Christ, come forward," and my cousin would kind of nudge me, and I was paralyzed because I didn't know, I couldn't go up and receive, and that was also, I felt so outside of that. So although I believed in God, I believed that God didn't believe in me because I wasn't doing the right thing, and I had a very, very limited experience of what religion and spiritual expression was. My mother is an atheist. But I said, but where do dreams come from? You know, like, I have these amazing dreams. Where do they come from? Oh, that's just, you know, part of the neurological, some sort of explanation. So I wanted to, and in my using, I turned to religion. I took my kids to church, to different churches, to the Quakers. I loved the Quakers. I loved going to Quaker meeting. But my kids were so wild. My kids, you know, it was horrible being a mom in recovery because I had to bring my kids to meeting. And if I could try to pretend that my life wasn't unmanageable, coming to a meeting with my wild and completely unmanageable 4- and 5-year-old who used to just come to the meeting, and they might as well have just said, "My mother is a complete unmanageable addict," because their behavior was so, and it was shaming. You know, I felt so ashamed of what I had created in my children through my lack of parenting. And so going to Quaker meeting, and the children come in for, you know, you sit in silence in a Quaker meeting till someone's moved to speak. And the children would sit there for 15 minutes. My kids could not be silent, you know, for 2 minutes. And that, it was the same as bringing them to a meeting, that, you know, I felt that they were shaming me. You know, I was so self-obsessed that what my children did, and really what my children do is a big expression of how, what my relationship was with them. I had no way to detach. You know, I had no way to say in that Quaker meeting, "We're a family in trouble," and I'd love my kids to be silent, but I don't know how to do it. You know, so I bolted and I didn't go back there, and I tried different things. And I want to say something about how that's changed now, which I was sharing with a friend before the meeting, that my kids had their school report. They're now 12 and 13. The other day went for their school report. And my youngest son got a whole lot of D's in his report for behavioral stuff mostly. And I felt so, I had real acceptance around that. Even last year, I was thinking, I hope they get all A's because that would be a good reflection on me and everything would be fine. And of course, they didn't get all A's, but no one's ever had as many D's as my youngest son had on Wednesday. And I didn't feel that that was my fault. You know, those D's were not my D's. They were his D's. He knows what they're for. And he was like, "Wow." You know, and afterwards he said to me, "I can't believe I got such a bad report." He got, you know, really good English and history, AAA. But there were like 6 or 7 D's, a problem. You know, enough to indicate there's something here. And he owned it. And he said, "I've always had a better report than my friends. I don't know what I'm going to, you know, say to them." And I said, "Well, what do you think you can do?" He said, "Well, know what I can do? I can stop talking. I can ask to be moved so I don't sit next to so-and-so who always chats to me." And I thought, isn't that amazing? That, hold on a minute. That is because, that's recovery speaking there, because he is owning that. You know, and I was told, I've done some parenting courses as well, and they said it's always better if you let your child assess. You know, which is quite good if you're sponsoring someone as well. You know, I found myself in my early days as a sponsor sort of saying, well, I think maybe you should do this. And then thinking, that sounds awful. They shouldn't do anything. I can only say what I did. And mostly all I can say is go to a meeting and work the steps and support them through that. But my son was able to assess that, how his work was, and that it wasn't good enough for him, and what he could do to change it. And I realized that the reason why I want, you know, I don't want to, I'm not a using addict anymore, and I was so, I don't want, you know, and I'm a single mom, and I sometimes feel there's a stigma about that, and, you know, and I'm on a low income, so my kids are classified as free school meals, and the government says that kids on free school meals don't achieve as well as other kids, and I don't want that for my kids. I want my kids to do really well. I don't want to be on free school meals. I want to be earning a better living, and I know I will be if I keep coming. And but I thought it was great that I was able to detach from that and say, just because that kid has some D's does not mean he's a bad kid, does not mean I'm a bad mother. It's not me getting that school report the way I used to have the anxiety. So I felt like that was a way of growing up. And that was a diversion from the step three. Step four, my sponsor asked me to write my life story, which I did. And 3 minutes, okay. And sharing my step four, sharing things that I'll just say about sharing my step five was that there was one thing in particular in there that I was so full of shame about I'd never told anyone. Nobody knew. And my sponsor said, write it all down. If you don't want to share it on the day, you don't have to. You can leave it for another time. And I did share it with her. And within 3 minutes of sharing it, she shared back, and we were killing ourselves laughing about it. You know, this thing that I thought that I had dragged around since I was 12 years old, that was not, I was not the only person to have done that. Step six and seven, people say that the forgotten steps, and I really love them because I love learning more about myself and learning about how the defects operate in my life, because I don't feel like, I mean, we all have all of them, so it's not like something, I mean, I know I have more problem with some of them than others, but I feel like I have the tools. You know, for me, what I do is, okay, I'm impatient, so instead of saying, how can I not be impatient, I say to my higher power, please give me a bit of patience. You know, what's the, you know, the neutralizing thing? If I'm feeling intolerant, please grant me some tolerance here, and it helps me to take the action. Eight and nine, I've made amends to everyone in my family except for one of my sisters, and I've had the miraculous thing of walking around the corner and there being somebody there who I hadn't seen for 13 years to whom I owed an amend. So my higher power is doing things that I can't do. Step 10, I don't do a formal thing about a daily writing. I do a little check-in sometimes, not every day. The way I do my step 10 is if I say something or do something and a little flag goes up in my mind, I'll go back and think, why did that little flag go up in my mind? Oh yeah, I said that thing out of arrogance, and then I can take it from there. Step 11 I talked about, and step 12 for me, being of service in the fellowship, putting out chairs, greeting a newcomer, trying to remember newcomers' names as people remembered mine, and that went a really long way with me coming back because I felt known. I felt like I wasn't invisible. And I think I'll just leave it there. Thank you very much. Thanks.